So my title is Beyond the Standard Model Phenomenology. So I decided to interpret that title a little bit generously, in the sense that I feel that one can't really discuss beyond the standard model without first of all reviewing the status of the standard model, because that way you formulate the issues that lie beyond it. And in particular, as I'm sure you all know, one of the big issues beyond the standard model is the origin of particle masses, and in particular, whether or not they're due to a Higgs boson, or maybe multiple Higgs bosons. So, in fact, this lecture is going to be largely taken up with the first two lines here, excluding the parenthesis S. The parenthesis S come later on. In the second lecture, I'm going to be discussing some of the alternatives to simple-minded Higgs, including, multiple Higgs bosons, but also the scenario in which there's no Higgs boson at all, which, as I tell politicians who visit CERN, will be even more interesting than finding a boring old Higgs boson. Oh, yes, they say they believe me. Then, anybody who knows me will know that I am infatuated with SUSY, so I'll spend some time talking about supersymmetry, searches for supersymmetric particles in particular, but perhaps not exclusively at the LHC. And then I'll finish off by discussing a few topics that may or may not have any implications for the LHC. One of them is neutrinos and grand unification. And another one is at least a few words about the possibilities of extra dimensions and string theory. So I think somebody's already asked me whether I'm going to say anything about black holes at the LHC. I'm sure that I'll find time to say something about them, although what I say about them might not be printable. Okay, so that's the general outline. Let's start off with the Lagrangian of the standard model. So these are the particles out of which it's composed. So it's pretty much of a sort of untidy looking rag bag of particles. Some of them are electroweak doublets, some of them are singlets, some of them have colour, some of them have fractional charge. There's no very obvious pattern to what particles have what charges, what hypercharges, and so on. This is the way in which we are told they interact. So this actually is short enough to write on a t-shirt, and indeed if you invest 25 Swiss francs at the CERN shop, you can buy one. I thought that I had one in my bag here, but when I looked, I didn't find it, so I apologise. I cannot go through my normal ritual saying, well, the first line on the t-shirt is the gauge interactions and so on. So anyway, here we are. So the first line here, those are the gauge interactions where the index A runs over SU3, SU2 and U1. Then we have the interactions of the matter fermions with the gauge particles, this D here with a slightly off-center slash, supposed to be a covariant derivative, including implicitly the gauge interactions. So these are actually the two bits that we pretty much know must be true. Right? This is the bit that's actually been verified with high precision by, for example, experiments at LEM. The two bottom lines are what we theorists have been indoctrinating you experimentalists to believe in for the last 45 years, but quite honestly we do not know whether it's right or not, and we've got all sorts of indications that something like it must be right, but we don't actually have any proof that anything that I've written on the two bottom lines is actually correct. So what you see here is so-called Yukawa interactions between the fermions psi and Higgs field phi. So that's supposed to be the way in which particles get their masses. So the Higgs field phi has a kinetic term, and it has an effective potential. We'll discuss in more detail what the form of that effective potential is supposed to be. But there's absolutely, as I said, no direct experimental evidence for this phi, and hence for these two bottom lines there. So, let's zero in a little bit more on what we have hidden within those four lines of the standard model. So we've got three completely separate gauge group factors, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. The level of the standard model, there is no understanding of why we have these particular gauge group factors. Why don't we have an SU4? Maybe a G2 or something like that. Hopefully, that's something that the grand unified theory could eventually describe, if not actually explain. Also, as written there, there's the fact that the SU3 interaction is strong and the SU2 cross U1 interaction is weak. But of course, one reason why it's weak is because the SU2 gauge bosons are heavy. But even if you allow for that fact, just the intrinsic coupling of the SU2 and U1 is quite a bit weaker than the strong coupling. It's again something which we might hope to understand with a grand unified theory. But at the level of the standard model, it's just the way things are. So that means that we have these three different gauge couplings for the different gauge groups. And one of the key items on the agenda for grand unification is to try to figure out some relations between them. There's also the fact that if you look at the SU2 and U1 electroweak interactions, they're actually mixed together. There is, in particular, this angle called theta W. Some people call it theta Weinberg. In fact, as far as I'm aware, it was first discovered by, or postulated by, Glashow, so maybe the W stands for the last letter in Glashow, not the first letter in Weinberg. The weak mixing angle. Okay. So this weak mixing angle mixes together the U1 gauge boson A and the third component of the SU2 doublet. So the value of this mixing angle is related to the ratio between the SU2 and the U1 couplings. But there's no fundamental understanding of why these things mix in the way that they do, and why this parameter sine squared theta has a particular value that it does. Experimentally, it's known to very high accuracy, probably even a little bit more accurate than what I've written down here. I guess pretty good work, actually. That's been known to better than one part per mil, largely thanks to the efforts of the Central Lab experiments, of course, more recently the Tevatron experiments. A little bit more about the weak interactions. So you know that, as I already mentioned very briefly, left-handed leptons come in doublets. So simplest example, the electron neutrino doublet. Those are then coupled through a vector-type interaction with the W boson. And when I was your age, that was conjecture. Then it was shown to be true. Neutral current interactions go through something very rather similar. Again, there's a vector here, although this is actually a combination of a vector and axial vector coupling to the boson. Uh, you come to the quarks, you get a somewhat similar structure. As you know, there's a bunch of doublets called quarks, rather similar to those doublets called leptons. But as you also know, there are these quark doublets mix. And there is the Covino-Kobayashi-Mascara matrix, which characterizes the relationship between the mass eigenstates and the electroweak interaction eigenstates. And there should be some primes there. Whenever you show these slides, you always find another bunch of typos. If you find any more typos, shadow them. So, again, we don't have any fundamental understanding of why these things mix in the way that they do. And there's probably, I would guess, even more theoretical ink expended on trying to construct models for this than there is for theories of grand unification. So I hope that I've described, convinced you that there's a bunch of issues there in the standard model. There's a generally issues of flavor. Why are there so many different types of particles and why do they mix in the way that they do? There's problems with the gauge interactions. Why those particular gauge interactions? Why do they have that particular strength? And of course, there's a problem of mass. As I said a couple of moments ago, we've got no direct evidence that that Higgs boson actually exists. All that having been said, of course, the standard model actually works remarkably well. And I think this is one of the great disappointments, I would say, of experiments over the last decade or two. That you guys, girls, have done your best to prove that the standard model is wrong, and you haven't succeeded. It's still working, with one possible exception that I'll come back to later on. So what I put here is it's in perfect agreement with all confirmed accelerator data, confirmed, giving me a little bit of wiggle room that I will exploit later. Moreover, this consistency with, in particular, the precision electroweak data coming from LEP Tevatron works if and only if there is something very much resembling that infamous Higgs boson that we had on the bottom two lines of the standard model Lagrange in a couple of slides ago. And this, I think, is why many of us theorists are so convinced is not quite the right word. So, we're so enamored of the Higgs mechanism because the data just seem to be pointing in that direction, even though they haven't actually found direct evidence for it. Moreover, as I'm going to discuss in some detail later on, not only does this something like a Higgs boson have to exist, but it also has to presumably have a relatively low mass. You could have found consistency between the data and the standard model and found a preferred mass of 1 TeV for the Higgs boson. If you had, that could have been a little bit embarrassing for the LHC because the LHC has some capability to look for a Higgs boson up to about 1 TeV, but you'd really have to bust a gut to do it. In fact, the mass looks more like it's less than 180, maybe less than 150 GeV, which means that certainly kinematically there should be enough central mass energy to find the bugger. Nevertheless, we still don't know whether this is the origin of particle masses, and as I already mentioned, we don't know. Have got any good ideas about the flavor problem, and unification is still up in the air. So I'm sure that you've all seen this sort of plot before, but nevertheless, it's an important type of plot to look at, so let's just look at it once again. So these are measurements from LEP of the coupling of the Z boson two leptons, so the lepton coupling and the axial coupling. So if you forgot about calculating quantum effects, this thing here, for example, would be minus 0.5. Well, experimentally, it's not minus 0.5. It deviates at the per mil level, and that per mil deviation is a reflection of the contributions of quantum loops involving, in particular, massive particles. So here you see a calculation within the standard model, how it depends on the value of the top quark mass, how it depends on the Higgs mass. Now, what you also see here are ellipses corresponding to the measurements of the couplings to the three different lepton flavors, and then an average, which is a black ellipse. And what you see is that at the per mil level, the measured values of the lepton couplings agree with the standard model. Moreover, they favor a relatively small value for the Higgs mass. So this would be a 1 TeV Higgs up there somewhere, and this is 100 GeV Higgs down here. So this is just one example of one set of data which push you to the conclusion that you need something like a Higgs boson, and that it quite probably does not weigh very much. So, of course, there's a whole bunch of other data, and here's some of them down here. These are the data that one typically includes in a global fit. Some of them don't agree so well with the standard model. For example, here's one here, forward backward asymmetry for B quarks. Of course, if you're compiling a list of 20 observables, one of them is going to disagree by more than two standard deviations. If you look at the overall quality of the fit, it's not so bad. It could be better, but it's not terribly poor either. Now, there are some people who say, well, you know, maybe this discrepancy in particular is significant, and maybe we should be a little bit more careful in the interpretation of the electroweak data, and I'll come back to that in tomorrow's lecture. But for the moment, let me take it at face value. Everything is more or less okay with the precision test of the standard model. So, let's just summarize the parameters that we have in the standard model. So, we've got three gauge couplings. We've also got a phase parameter that appears in QCD, which doesn't have any effects in perturbative calculations, but is potentially important at the level of non-perturbative calculations. This parameter would violate CP. We know the strong interactions conserve CP to a vague approximation, something like 1 part in 10 to the 10. So it's actually kind of a puzzle as to why the CP violating phase is so small as it has to be. I'm not going to say very much about that. There are some theoretical ideas about why that might be the case, but I don't think I'm going to discuss it very much in these lectures. I'd be happy to answer questions about it. Anyway, so that gave four parameters up there. Then you've got the sector where the various different fermions get their masses. So there's three charged lepton masses, not a typo, six quark masses, and four CKM angles and phase. So that's another 13 parameters, and we basically don't have any decent theory of where they come from. Maybe with ground unification we might get some clues relating some of those different masses, but I'll maybe discuss that in a later lecture. Then we come to the bottom line of the standard model Lagrangian, which is not on this t-shirt. So there we had an effective potential for the Higgs, and that actually has two parameters. One of them is a quadratic parameter, which actually sets the overall mass scale for the Higgs boson. And the other one is a quartic parameter, which is the thing which stabilizes the potential for large values of the Higgs. Now we'll come back to that in more detail later on. Of course, if you replace the simplest Higgs structure by something more complicated, you're going to get a shitload more parameters there. Nevertheless, putting all these together, you've already got 19 parameters. So I think it's pretty obvious that the standard model is not adequate as a possible theory of everything. And we would like to bring a little bit of order to the gauge sector by some sort of grand unified theory. We'd like to have some theory of flavor, which would bring a little bit of order to the middle ranking of the batting. And we like to tidy up this mass problem down the bottom here. So, what is the origin of particle masses? Is it due to a Higgs boson or other physics? Now, I argue that within the context of the standard model, something like a Higgs boson should have a mass less than, say, a couple of hundred GeV. I think there are very general reasons for thinking that this new physics would have to have a scale less than about a TeV. Now, I'll come back to that a little bit later. So, this is something which certainly might show up at the LHC, so we devoutly hope that it's going to show up. On the other hand, I would say that there's no very clear evidence where the problem of flavor is going to be solved. Maybe some new flavor physics is going to occur at the TeV scale. Alternatively, maybe we find some new physics at the TeV scale, and we have to explain why it doesn't have an exciting flavor structure. Unification of the fundamental forces, according to the sort of naive grand unification models, that's likely to occur not until something like 10 to the 16 GeV. So that's really going to be kind of tough to explore directly, although maybe one could look at it indirectly through neutrino physics, masses and couplings and so on. Now, what I've said up to now is basically a sort of particle physicist view of what are the big questions. If you asked a general relativist, she'd say something completely different. She'd say, well, you have to formulate a quantum theory of gravity, and she probably wouldn't care very much about these other issues up here. In fact, Stephen Hawking has even on record as saying that he doesn't believe in the Higgs boson. And if you ever try reading a brief history of time, if you actually read the chapter that he has about particle physics, it's sort of pretty cursory. So there's a whole other bunch of questions which I don't have time to solve on the t-shirt to do with the quantum theory of gravity. Maybe it's going to be solved by string theory, in which case the challenge is to find some experimental signature of it. One possibility is there might be additional space-time dimensions. As I said, maybe I'll have something to say about dimensional dementia in my last lecture. Now, I already advertised the fact that I'm a fan of supersymmetry. For some reason, people laugh when I bring these things on from the side. It doesn't matter much what I bring on, but as long as I bring on something. I would argue that supersymmetry has a role in many of these different things. Perhaps not the problem of flavor, but certainly in helping us sort out the Higgs. Supersymmetry also seems to play a role in grand unification. Might actually give us a way of calculating the value of sine squared theta that I advertised as a very accurately measured parameter a few slides back. And it also seems to be an essential feature of superstring theory. So I would argue that there are reasons why we should be spending a lot of time thinking about and looking for supersymmetry. So here is a sort of general logarithmic overview of energy scales in physics, going all the way from the 100 GeV of LEP up to the 10 to the 90 GeV, which is the one where we know the quantum effects in gravity have to become strong. Now, I would argue that prospects for finding a lot of physics within the TV range, which is going to be explored at the LHC. As you know, mass, I've already talked about dark matter. There's various different candidates for what the dark matter in the universe might be. And, for example, there's candidates in supersymmetry, there's even candidates in extra dimensions. So there's also independent reasons for thinking that dark matter in many models has to have a mass scale of the order of a TeV or so. So I'm pretty optimistic, as I'll discuss in more detail later on, that the problem of dark matter might also be addressed by the LHC. However, I think it's clear there's a bunch of aspects of physics beyond the standard model which are likely to be accessible only indirectly, if at all, at the LHC, and where astrophysics and cosmology might play a role. So although what I'm going to be talking about for most of these lectures is largely centred in the LHC for obvious reasons, because that's what most of you are working on, nevertheless I will slip in a bit of astrophysics and cosmology from time to time. Maybe I pause for a moment and see whether anybody wants to ask a question, have a comment. Anybody dare have a go? Josh has a question. Try to make a grand unified theory? Well, I think mathematically it's relatively easy to write down a candidate structure for what such a thing might have. The problem is that when you write it down, as I will try to explain later on, at least in the simple theories, the energy scale at which it occurs is unbelievably high. So the problem is actually to formulate experimental tests of it. Grand unified theories were formulated before most of you were born, certainly before the students were born. And then people said, well, look, maybe we can test them with proton decay. But that didn't work. Then people said, well, maybe we can test them with neutrino masses. Well, neutrino masses have been found, but the connection to specific grand unified theories is difficult to pin down. So I think the real problem is just this sort of disconnect between the energy scale at which grand unification should occur and the scale at which we can do experiments. Okay, so why do things weigh? So these two honorable geezers told us that weight was proportional to mass, energy was related to mass, but unfortunately they forgot to explain where the mass came from. And that's where this guy comes in. So he was supposed to come up here with me yesterday, but unfortunately he couldn't make it. Anyway, so here's the main man himself, Peter Higgs. And as you know, his theory has become our holy grail. As I'll mention in a little bit more detail in a moment, the sorts of ideas that Peter Higgs incorporated in his theory are quite closely related to the ideas that got Nanbu half the Nobel Physics Prize in 2008. And I can't help feeling the Nobel Prize Committee was probably scrabbling very hard to get, you know, all these other worthy candidates out of the way, so that when you guys and girls eventually discover the Higgs boson, that Mr. Higgs will be able to go to Stockholm, assuming he's still above the surface of the planet at that time. So, about 20 years ago, we were a bit nervous about whether the British government wanted to continue investing in high energy physics. We're getting nervous again. So just find it so funny. So, last time the Minister of Science was actually quite keen on particle physics, so he encouraged us to come up with some argument that would convince his colleagues of how important it was. In particular, he had a competition to illustrate the idea of Mr. Higgs. So, this is a winning entry, which asks you to think of the vacuum as being a non-trivial medium. Now, many of you may think that the vacuum is empty, right? Certainly in the LHC, you hope that what is called the vacuum is going to be empty. But actually, from the point of view of theoretical physics, that's not what the vacuum is. The vacuum is actually just the lowest energy state, and in general, the lowest energy state could be quite complicated. It's a non-trivial medium. And so the idea that was proposed was that you think of an analogy between a vacuum and a cocktail party where people are sort of muttering away. These are like quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. And you know, at a cocktail party, there's never complete silence. Right? So in the same way, there's always these little quantum fluctuations going on. So then what happens, I think in the original formulation, it was a then infamous female politician that came into the cocktail party. But I've transcribed this in more universal language. So you put a particle through this medium, and Tony with an update. So this medium interacts with the particle. As Einstein is fighting his way to the bar, he gets surrounded by all these people that want to find out what he thinks about every issue under the sun. And so he gets slowed down. So as you know, a particle with mass always travels at less than the speed of light. And here we are with Einstein traveling at less than the speed of light as he crosses the cocktail room on his way to the bar. Now, there's another possible extension of this idea, which is so-called spontaneous excitation of the vacuum. Supposing there's a rumour that some famous politician or scientist might come, and then this rumour propagates across the room. The message is passed across from person to person across the cocktail. And this would be the analogue of the Higgs boson. This is a quantum excitation of the vacuum, which propagates across the room. It propagates at less than the speed of light, reflecting the fact that the Higgs boson itself also has a mass. So that's the analogy for the Higgs mechanism that was proposed 20 years ago and was still in circulation. Since we're in Scotland, I'd like you to think about a different analogy. Think of an infinite flat snowfield extending in all directions. Think of a skier. The skier skims across the surface of the snowfield at a very high velocity. That's like a particle that does not interact with the Higgs medium, and so it travels at the speed of light. Now consider somebody with snowshoes. So somebody with snowshoes interacts with the snow, they sink into the snow, they move more slowly. That's like a particle with mass, electron maybe. And of course, if you consider a hiker who doesn't have any snow equipment on at all, then he just sinks very deeply into the snow, interacts very strongly with the snow, and acquires a very large mass, and moves very slowly. So I think this actually illustrates the principal features of the Higgs mechanism and also indicates the principal limitations of the Higgs mechanism. The Higgs mechanism tells you how particles acquire mass by interaction, but it doesn't give you a theory of how strong these interactions are. There's nothing in Mr. Higgs's theory that tells you what size boots the hiker is wearing. That's, if you like, the problem of flavour, is to explain the sizes of opinions about those sorts of notions. Anyway, you all know that a snowfield is made up out of snowflakes, and in some sense, your job as LHC experimentalists is to look for the snowflake of the standard model, namely the Higgs boson, the elementary quantum. Okay, enough of pictures. This is the moment in the lecture when your concentration should be the highest. So let's look in more detail at the Higgs theory, the Higgs mechanism. So he postulated an effective potential with quadratic term and quartic term. There's nothing particularly mysterious about this. If you want a theory which is going to be normalizable, i.e. calculable, it basically the only things it can have are a quartic term and a quadratic term. Now, you could argue a little bit about the sign. Can't argue much about the sign of a quartic term, because that's what makes the potential go up at large values of the field. And if that was negative, the thing would be unstable. That's obviously... perhaps, obviously, bad. Actually, we'll come back to that possibility later on. But let's assume that lambda is positive. How about quadratic term? Well, that could be either positive or negative. And Mr. Higgs explored the possibility that it's negative, which for our purposes is the interesting one. It's interesting because if you now calculate the minimum of the effective potential, remember the vacuum is the lowest energy state, so we have to minimize the effective potential, then you find that that occurs at a non-zero value of the Higgs field, which is simply given by mu squared and lambda. Now, we don't know... Sorry, I should have perhaps made it clear before. The Higgs is a doublet. It has two components in it. And you might say, well, which component requires a vacuum expectation value? That actually doesn't matter. When you have spontaneous symmetry making of this type, whether you say it's the first component or the second component, eventually it doesn't matter. But anyway, let's say it's this second component here. Now, if you put a non-zero vacuum expectation value into all those couplings, matter, psi, phi, okay, then you're going to get a psi coupling, and that's what we call a mass term. So the couplings of the fermions are proportional to their Yukawa couplings. Yukawa couplings, if you like, what's the arbitrary shoe sizes that we were talking about earlier on. And the W boson, that requires a mass which is fixed, because you know what the coupling is of the W boson, it's G. And then if you go through and calculate the mass of the Higgs boson, actually you will find that there's two components with different masses. One component is actually massless, and the other one is mass if. The one that's mass if has a mass which is related to the to this parameter mu squared. That's why I said earlier on that the parameter mu sets the overall scale for the Higgs mass. Now, experimentally, we know the value of the W mass, we know the value of the Higgs vacuum expectation value, we know the value of F of G there, but we don't know the values of mu and lambda. As long as they're in this relationship here, and as long as they're in this relationship here, you get the vacuum expectation value, you can vary mu and lambda as much as you like, as long as mu squared is negative, it's minus mu squared, and as long as lambda is positive. So, what happens to the gauge bosons? So, in a little bit more detail, here is how they acquire their masses. So, here I've just repeated the gauge kinetic terms in the original Higgs Lagrangian, and just for fun, I've written out the full field strengths here, including those non-abelian interaction terms for the SU2 part then. And here is the Higgs field. So I talked previously about the effective potential. Here I've written out the kinetic term. Kinetic term has covariant derivatives. The covariant derivatives involve not just d mu, but also w's and the U1 gauge boson. So, if you expand all this around the vacuum, which has non-zero expectation value for the field phi, it's clear that, for example, you're going to get a term which is quadratic in the W's here. Okay, because in that Lagrangian, there's going to be a term which looks like phi W times phi W. And you put in phi equal to that, and you're going to get a mass squared term W. It's also clear that you're going to get something similar, a mass term for the U1V boson. And also, if you think about it a bit, you're going to get a term which mixes the U1 boson with the neutral component of the SU2 boson. So this, folks, is where the mixing between the U1 and the SU2 boson arises in the standard model. It arises because when you do the spontaneous symmetry breaking, you necessarily get this combination of diagonal and non-diagonal terms in the mass squared matrix, and you have to diagonalize them to get the mass eigenstates. And so those are the Z boson and the massless photon, okay, which are orthogonal combinations of W and P. So that mixing just arises because of the way the kinetic terms are set up. Now, I said a moment ago that the fundamental theory doesn't tell us anything about what the mass of the Higgs boson is itself. But I also commented a few slides back that the electroweak observables are sensitive to massive particles, in particular the top quark and the Higgs boson. So we do have some constraints on what the Higgs mass can be coming from those radiative corrections. So I'm not going to go into the details of how one calculates those radiative corrections. I kind of guess that Sven Heinemeier will talk about that. Anyway, this is one particular radiative correction to the W and the Z masses, which depends not only on the top quark mass, quadratically on the top quark mass, but also logarithmically on the mass of the Higgs boson. So if you could do something like measuring the W and Z masses very accurately, then you might hope to get some constraint on at least one combination of M top and M Higgs. And if you measure enough of these electroweak precision observables, you might be able to estimate both of them. So that was what we were hoping back in the early 1990s. In fact, it was possible to use those precision electroweak data to predict what the mass of the top quark should be. That turned out to be correct when it was discovered by Fermilab Tevatron in the middle of the 1990s. And so now you can, with more accuracy, estimate what the mass of the Higgs is going to be. So this is kind of tough because, as you can see here, the sensitivity to the mass of the Higgs boson is only logarithmic. So you really have to measure with very high accuracy if you want to get a sensible constraint on the mass of the Higgs boson. But this is the current state of play. I'll maybe put this in a bit more detail later on. More detail perhaps is warranted, but very roughly speaking, you can say the mass of the Higgs boson should be 80 plus or minus 30 GeV, where the error is on a logarithmic scale approximately Gaussian. Now, I might just comment that some people say that there is some tension between this and the lower limit on the mass of the Higgs boson that comes from direct searches at left, which is 114 GeV. Well, you know, we've all seen one standard deviation effects come and go. I don't think there's any serious conflict here. Although, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a hint that something may be going on, and I'll perhaps come to, back to that later on. I was going to say a little bit about the relationship of Mr. Higgs to Mr. Nambu. In fact, maybe it would have been helpful to have shown this picture a little bit earlier on, because it's an illustration of the way the spontaneous symmetry breaking works. So this here is a potential which has the form that I described earlier on. So there's a quartic term, lambda positive, which makes the thing go up, large field values. And there's a minus mu squared phi squared at the origin, so the origin is unstable. So the potential has this bottom of a wine bottle shape, or Mexican hat shape. Right, so the lowest energy state is somewhere around the bottom of the Mexican hat here. And Nambu essentially was the person who described this and applied it to pion physics. And his basic point was that if you have here a degree of freedom that corresponds to going around the bottom of the Mexican hat, and that's a massless particle, so-called Nernst-Goldstone boson. Don't ask me about this. So what happens in Mr. Higgs' theory is that this massless component going around the bottom is actually eaten to give a mass to a massive gauge boson. And what you're left with is a degree of freedom which corresponds to the radial motion here. And that's basically Mr. Higgs's claim to fame. Looking at this Mexican hat potential, the Higgs boson corresponds to moving radially, and the Nambu-Goldstone boson corresponds to going around the bottom. So I don't know whether this bottom of the wine bottle potential is worth two Nobel Prizes, but maybe. So I'm not going to say a tremendous amount about looking for the Higgs boson. I'll say a little bit about it, but I assume this is going to be discussed in more detail by other lecturers. I just wanted to remind you of a couple of essential features. So one is that Higgs couplings, of course, are proportional to their mass. That means, in particular, that decays into heavier particles are favoured if they're kinematically accessible. And that explains most of the features here. For example, as soon as the Higgs boson becomes heavier than a pair of W's or a pair of Z's, then it likes to decay into W or Z pairs. If it's heavier than twice the top mass, then it also likes to decay into M top. If it's below, say, 100 GeV, then its preferred decay mode is into BV bar, and then tau plus, tau minus, and CC bar also appear there. What you notice is that there are a few other decay modes or couplings which are also present. For example, there's decay into two gluons. That basically comes about through a loop diagram, as does the coupling of the Higgs to gamma-gamma. Top loop diagram is crucial for the production of the Higgs via gluon collisions at the LHC. And if you're looking at the decay of the Higgs into gamma-gamma, then you write down a similar loop, but not just with heavy coloured particles going around, but with heavy charged particles going around. So it is true that the most important couplings are proportional to the mass, but there are also important loop couplings, which in particular are important for the for the LHC Higgs phenomenology. So now I want to say a little bit more detail about the indications we currently have about the Higgs mass, also because I think they may be giving us some indications about possible Higgs physics beyond the Standard Model, even in the Higgs sector. So this is a compilation of the precision electroweak measurements. So on the right-hand side here, we have what I was telling you about earlier on, that the preferred value for the Higgs mass, according to those precision electroweak measurements, is a bit under 100 GeV. Precisely what the value is, so as I should explain, this is a chi-squared function as a function of the Higgs mass on a logarithmic scale. As you can see, the likelihood function is quite Gaussian on that logarithmic scale. These different curves correspond to slightly different theoretical assumptions built into the Standard Model fit. The differences between them are quite small, still compared to the experimental errors. And this is what gives you this estimate, let's say 80 plus or minus 30 GeV for the mass of the Higgs boson. Now, I showed you previously one of the elements that goes into that, namely the coupling of the Z to leptons. Here's another one, which is a combination of the measurements of the top quark mass and the W mass. So, before, in fact, not including the measurement of the top quark mass by the Tevatron experiments, just using the precision electroweak data alone, you would get this sort of mango-shaped region, red dotted line here, which would be the preferred range of M top and W. Now, as you can see, the experimental measurement of M top actually sits very nicely within this predicted range. I think it's an absolutely fantastic success in the Standard Model. Parenthetically, it's probably that sort of plot that Nobel Prize for Tuft and Veltman a few years ago. So what we're interested in now is the mass of the Higgs. So what you see here are lines in this plane for various different choices of the Higgs mass. So this is 114, nominally the lowest possible mass to this. And you see that the measurement of MW is actually a little bit on the high side. This is the one sigma effect that I was talking about earlier on. This is actually not the latest version of this. I think the latest version is even moved up just a smidgen. So there's a sort of an interesting issue there. But perhaps we'll, as I said, come back to that later on. So the state of play at the moment is that we've got this lower limit on the mass of the Higgs. We've got a best fit value for the Higgs mass, which, as I commented earlier on, is about 80 plus or minus 30. If you do not include the direct limit, then the upper limit on the Higgs mass is about 185 GeV. If you include it, so if you don't include it, it's 154 GeV. If you include the lower limit, it's 185. Now, there is an addition to that, which is the fact that the Tevatron a few months ago announced an additional exclusion of the Higgs mass, which is a range between 160 and 170 GeV. So at the 95% confidence level, either it has to be bigger than 170 or it has to be less than 160. So that actually excludes the region over here somewhere, which is sort of in the region which naively you might think was disfavored by the precision electroweak data. Nevertheless, the combination of that and the precision electroweak data is interesting, as I'll discuss in just a moment. So this is the Tevatron exclusion. So the jagged line represents the upper limit that they have on Higgs production relative to the Standard Model prediction, which is shown here as a straight line at 1. So what you see is that in most of the mass range, the upper limit is above the Standard Model calculation, except in that range between 160 and 170 GeV. I did actually check yesterday evening that at the ongoing Lipton Photon conference, they didn't announce a new exclusion. So at least as of yesterday evening, they hadn't announced one. There's going to be a session on electron beam physics tomorrow, I believe. So if there's any news, I'll let you know. Anyway, for the moment, that's the state of play. So this is what happens if you combine the precision electron beam data with the Tevatron exclusion. Previously, we had a nice sort of parabolic curve, and this parabolic curve has now been eroded by this Tevatron exclusion. So there's actually a band here, which is where it's formally excluded at the 95% confidence level. But you see that on either side of that, the likelihood function is eroded by the fact that although you can't exclude the Higgs boson there, it certainly seems to be disfavored. So in fact, the Tevatron has implications for Higgs's all the way between, well, probably about 140 GeV and 200 GeV. And it's interesting to combine the information with the precision electron beam data. Anyway, this is what you get formally according to the G-Fitter collaboration. You get a best fit value for M Higgs of 116.4 plus 15.6 minus 1.3. Those of you with particularly good telescopes may be able to see a little blip here in the likelihood function. That little blip there is the hint of a Higgs at the end of the year 2000 in the Allen experiment. I don't know what this is going on there. I'm never going to figure that out. Anyway. So that's the current state of our information about the Higgs within the standard model. So we can have a little bit of theoretical fun with this. And I would actually argue that that plot is actually suggesting to us that there is some new physics beyond the standard model at an energy scale less than M Planck. How does the argument go? Well, here we've got a logarithmic scale, some energy up to which the standard model should remain valid. And the vertical axis here is the mass of the Higgs. Remember, the mass of the Higgs is related to the overall strength of the Higgs self-coupling lambda. Okay, the Higgs mass squared is related to mu squared. Mu squared over lambda is the vacuum expectation value squared. We know what the vacuum expectation value is. And so the value of the Higgs mass squared is proportional to lambda. So the bigger the mass, the bigger lambda. Lambda here being small lambda, which is the quartic self-coupling of the Higgs. Now, if that self-coupling is too big, then when you run the theory up to high energies, the coupling gets bigger and bigger, and eventually it blows up. And that's what's shown as these blue lines here. Of course, you can't actually rely on calculations when you get to infinity, but maybe you can believe the calculation up to pi, or maybe up to 2 pi. Anyway, those lines are kind of close together. And what they tell you is that, for example, if the mass of the Higgs is 250 GeV, then the theory will blow up somewhere around 10 to the 7 GeV. And if you extrapolated that up there somewhere, then if the mass of the Higgs was about 700 GeV, then you would discover it would blow up at 700 GeV. So that's telling you that you can't postpone Higgs physics indefinitely. If you push the Higgs above a mass of about a TeV, then the theory would blow up at a TeV. Okay, now coming down here, you see that the blow up is postponed if the Higgs mass is 170 GeV, and there's actually a range of Higgs masses where the theory does not blow up before 10 to the 19 GeV. What happens if the Higgs coupling is smaller? Well, if the Higgs coupling is smaller, it turns out that you get a different type of instability coming in, which is the normalization due to the top book. That has the opposite sign. It tends to reduce the coupling as you go to higher energies. So the coupling, instead of being positive, which means stability, becomes negative, which means instability. And so that's what's happening down in this region over here. And there is a narrow range of masses between, let's say, 170 and 130 GeV, where the theory doesn't blow up, doesn't collapse, survives all the way to the Planck mass. So actually, I think this is the worst possible range. That's the most boring range. In that theory, Mr. Higgs's theory remains valid up to M Planck, and there's no need for any other physics. And that would be a fucking disaster. Excuse my French. Now, in fact, we're probably more likely to be in this region here, which is much more interesting. So, this region is shown in a bit more detail here. So, let's suppose that you want your theory to be stable all the way up to some value of lambda, let's say 10 to the 12 GeV. Then what this plot is telling you is that your Higgs has to be bigger than, let's say, 130, maybe as low as whatever this is, 123 GeV. So if you're up there, the theory is stable. If you're down here, it's unstable. But how unstable is it going to be? Well, it depends, again, on what the mass is. It could actually be that although the vacuum is theoretically unstable, in fact, its lifetime is longer than the age of the universe so far. And, well, basically, if you're above this blue region here, then indeed the theory is effectively stable, if it's not actually stable. So, I mean, it's got a long lifetime. So, what is the probable fate of the standard model according to this likelihood function that I showed you a moment ago? So, if you didn't have the Tevatron, this would be the answer. So, the most likely range of Higgs masses would be down here, corresponding to a theory collapsing before 10 to the 7 GeV. But, no, you couldn't be sure. It could be all the way up there somewhere, in which case it could either be absolutely stable or the theory would actually blow up rather than collapse. If you put in the Tevatron exclusion, then actually it wipes out this top region. The standard model will not blow up. Climate of black holes at the LHC, I guess this is reassuring news. At the 99.2% confidence level, Higgs potential will not blow up, thanks to the Tevatron. And you see that the likelihood is squeezed down into this region here. The most likely hypothesis is that the standard model is actually going to collapse or blow up. This plot here actually shows you the relative confidence levels of different scenarios for the fate of the universe model. So this is the bit where it blows up, which, as I said, is disfavored at the 99% confidence level. This is the region where it's stable all the way up to the Planck mass. That would mean, for me, the ultimate disaster scenario. That's sort of disfavored at the level of, you know, factor of three relative to the most likely scenario, which is that we're in this unstable region over here. So the universe will probably collapse, but we're not quite sure. And this shows you the confidence level for the scale at which the potential will collapse. So as I said, it could survive all the way up to 10 to 19 GeV, although the most likely scenario is that it's going to acquire some sort of new physics at an energy scale less than 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 GeV. So I actually think this is relatively encouraging, because this is telling you that if not at the LHC, then sometime before Planck scale, we're likely to need new physics. Now, the LHC has the potential for making this issue a great deal sharper. So, Now, you guys and girls should be able to measure the Higgs mass with a precision of 1 per mil. So if you measure it to be 120 GeV, well, let's take 115 GeV, if you measured it to be right at that sort of LEP blip, okay, then that would tell you that for sure you'd need new physics below 10 to the 8 GeV, and very likely below 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 GeV. So that's why I would say that finding a relatively light Higgs boson would actually be relatively interesting. Now, I said that you need some sort of new physics. What sort of new physics could save the Higgs from this, save the universe collapse? Well, remember that I said that the Higgs self-coupling tends to reinforce itself and make it stronger and stronger and blow up. And the Higgs coupling to the top tends to make it go down. So if the top, if you're in a region where the top is winning, you want to put in some other scalar coupling to push it up a little bit. So let's introduce a top stop-like scalar. Actually, it doesn't much matter what the quantum numbers are, but just some scalar which is coupled to the Higgs. And then indeed, if you put it in at a low enough mass scale, that would prevent the theory from collapsing. And this plot is sort of illegible, in fact even I can't read it. But anyway, it's telling you that if you put in a scalar particle with the right mass and couplings, then you can prevent the potential from collapsing. On the other hand, you have to make sure that now you've introduced an additional scalar, that its couplings don't blow up as well. It actually turns out to be quite delicate to prevent the theory from either collapsing or from blowing up. And in fact, I can just about make out the fact that here I've tuned the parameter from 70.9 to 71.0, and we go from a theory that collapses to one that blows up. So, you have to introduce new physics. It has to be some sort of scalar particle, but you have to do it in a relatively finely tuned way. And one way of stabilizing it is to introduce a new fermion with the same quantum numbers as the Higgs, which just has the right effect of doing this fine tuning. So now I've got a new fermion to counterbalance the top, and I've got a new fermion, a new scalar to counterbalance the top, and I've got a new fermion to counterbalance the Higgses. So what I've got is a hell of a lot like supersymmetry. So I wouldn't actually claim that this is a theorem, but I think it's close to being a theorem that if you stick within the context of elementary particles as opposed to some sort of composite model, little Higgses or Technicolor or something like that, you stick with an elementary particle theory, I think you're going to have something pretty much like supersymmetry if you want to survive. Let's see. When should I be finishing? About now. So I will skip over some stuff which you've already heard about from Gunther. Let me just say, if you'll permit, a little bit more about looking for the Higgs at the LHC, and then I promise to shut up. So this here is a compilation of contributions to the Higgs production cross-section at the LHC as a function of its mass. So the dominant mechanism is this one here, glue-glue gives you Higgs. Then there are other interesting processes, like this is the WW fusion diagram, and okay, this is associated production of Higgs with the W, Higgs with the TT bar, and so on. So, interestingly enough, all these mechanisms are relevant in the relatively low mass region where we kind of expect the Higgs to show up. If the Higgs had been, if the Higgs were to be very heavy, then actually the production mechanisms you could actually see would be very limited. But because the Higgs is probably very light, in fact, there are a lot of ways to look for the Higgs boson. And some of them are shown here. Gunter already mentioned gamma-gamma, four leptons, TT by H, I think it's a bit unfashionable now, BB by H, maybe also unfashionable, but still, these are things that should be looked for in particular. They could be interesting in the case of Higgs bosons beyond the standard model. So, now this is going to provide a lot of work for a lot of you over the coming few years, chasing down all these different production mechanisms and decay modes, and combining all these results to try to send Mr. Higgs to Stockholm. Supposing that you do find something which has many of the right characteristics, how can you be sure that it is actually a Higgs boson? Of course, one of the absolutely key things is to check its spin, because the Higgs boson has no spin. What are the prospects for measuring its spin at the LHC? Well, in fact, there are some things that one can do. For example, if you see it decaying into gamma-gamma, then you know it cannot have spin 1. And there are various other different games that you can play. For example, in a large range of masses, it likes to decay into pairs of Zs. And one of the things that you can do is you can look for the angular distributions of the Z decay products. They're decaying into pairs of leptons. And then you can compute various different angular correlations. And these can be actually quite good at distinguishing between various different spin oscillators. If the mass is much less than a couple of hundred GeV, things get tougher, but still, there are some things that you can say. And as I mentioned in particular, if you see the decay into gamma, then it means it cannot possibly have spin 1. So, when will the LHC discover the Higgs boson? Good question, which I will not answer. This shows a compilation of how much well-understood integrated luminosity we need to define the Higgs. So, this is one inverse vector line here. Ultimately, one could hope for 100 inverse vector bars off the top there. What could one hope for over the coming year or so? Maybe 100 or 200 inverse picobars, if you're lucky. At a lower centre of mass energy, although that's not tremendously crucial for the producing of the Higgs boson. Anyway, with a couple of hundred inverse picobars at 14 TeV in the centre of mass, you would already be able to exclude a Higgs boson over this mass range here, including the tevatron excluded range, but also going up to much larger masses. So after a couple of hundred inverse picobarns, you could very well be in a situation where the Higgs boson either weighs less than 140 GeV, or it weighs more than 500 GeV, but from the electric weak fit, we're damn sure it doesn't weigh that much. So at that point, you'd really be pretty much focused on this low mass possibility. But you would need something approaching one inverse femtobarn to be actually able to claim a discovery. And in particular, if you wanted to claim a discovery in this nasty low mass region, then you might even require several inverse femtobarns. So it could be quite a number of years before we know for sure whether the Higgs boson exists, and if so, what its mass is. So I just hope that Peter stays in good health for a few more years yet. So, sometimes people tend to take the Higgs for granted. Don't take the Higgs for granted. First of all, it's a very important thing. How is gauge symmetry broken? Are there any elementary scalar fields? What happened in the early universe when it was 10 to minus 12 seconds old? Maybe the Higgs had something to do with the generation of matter. in the early universe. Maybe it has something to do with the inflation that is supposed to have expanded the universe when it was 10 to minus 35 seconds old. Higgs certainly contributes to dark energy. There's a lot of issues connected with the Higgs. So I would like to leave you with this image of the LHC roulette wheel, which will soon, we hope, start turning. And, well, on this particular turn, came up on one. So one standard model Higgs boson. And tomorrow we'll discuss the possibility that it might turn up one of these other numbers here. Thanks. Two basic philosophies that one can have going for. One is what I would describe as a sort of ambitious, or we may describe it as hubristic way forward, to say, let's imagine that our techniques of quantum field theory, elementary particles, work all the way up to the Planck scale. And let's see whether that works or not. Okay. Now, in order to do that, as I argued about 5 minutes ago, I think you really need something like supersymmetry. Because of what seems to be the hints emerging about the mass of the Higgs boson and then resulting instabilities and so on and so forth. So that, I think, is a reasonable thing to try to do. You take the tools that you have, perturbative quantum field theory, and you try to push it as far as you can and see whether it works or not. But, maybe that's not the right way to go. Maybe you should go through some sort of non-perturbative mechanism, and that's basically these things like little Higgses and so on are doing. In fact, little Higgses you can imagine as being a sort of reincarnation of Nambu's ideas, right? Because what you're doing is you're postulating there's a new set of strong interactions like QCD which somehow spit out a light particle which is the little Higgs boson. So it's not an unprecedented theory, but it's a more, to my mind, more complicated theory, and in some sense a more limited theory, because there's many different possible scenarios for what that strong interaction dynamics might be at the TeV or 10 TeV scale. Maybe we can come back to that after I've talked about them some more. Gauchos on their horses riding off into the horizon. Right? So it's supposed to somehow suggest far horizons and eventual implications.